Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the suspect behind a 20-year-old bombing in Saudi Arabia is reported under arrest. We'll get details. We'll have the tragic story of the murder of two American journalists. We continue our conversation on fighting ISIS propaganda.
You have an organization that claims to be not just Muslim, but more Muslim, more authentic than anyone else, purer.
And our music folks are chatting about the reuniting of Naomi and Wynonna Judd. It's on the Voice of America. A Saudi-owned newspaper says the man suspected of being the mastermind behind the truck bombing that killed 19 U.S. Air Force personnel in Saudi Arabia nearly 20 years ago has been arrested. My colleague Victor Beatty is following all this and joins me here in the studio. Victor, what have you found out?
Well, Susan, quoting an unnamed Saudi official, the Saudi-owned pan-Arab daily Asharq al-Awsat identified the suspect as 48-year-old Ahmed el-Mughassil, who was arrested in Beirut and repatriated back to Saudi Arabia. The Saudi publication said Mughassil is believed to be the leader of an Iran-allied Shia militant group implicated in the June 25, 1996 bombing of the 8-story Khobar Towers apartment complex near the eastern city of Dhahran. The blast also wounded hundreds of people. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, which placed Mughassil on its most wanted terrorist list, has offered a $5 million reward for information leading to his arrest. On Wednesday, U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby was asked about the reported arrest.
Well, I can't comment on these reports specifically. I think it's important to remember and to remind people about this attack, which killed 19 servicemen and one Saudi citizen, wounded 372 other people. And the United States continues to stand with the victims and families harmed by this attack. And we're going to continue working with Saudi Arabia and the international community to bring to justice all the perpetrators of it.
A U.S. federal judge in 2006 concluded that Tehran was responsible for the attack, a charge Iran has denied. The court also ordered Iran to pay the families of the victims more than $250 million. James Jeffries, a former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, was posted in Kuwait at the time of the bombing.
Justice needs to be done in every case where American blood has been shed, or the blood of anybody else that's innocent. Secondly, there is a very strong, direct, and red line leading from the rubble of Al-Quba to Tehran. And this guy might shed light on it because he has from everything I've seen about him, he has a very deep relationship with Iran, with the Revolutionary Guards. And that is my understanding from one who was in the region when that attack occurred and was trying to protect his post in Kuwait from a similar attack. And we've been attacked by Iranian surrogates in the 1980s. We looked into this, and it was very clear that the Iranians were behind it, without doubt.
Just remind our listeners exactly what happened.
A truck was driven up to the compound of the U.S. Air Force presence in Dhahran in eastern Saudi Arabia. Now, it's important for your listeners to remember that those people were there to execute Operation Southern Watch, which ironically existed to protect the Shia of southern Iraq from Saddam Hussein's deprivations. But nonetheless, the Iranian policy was Americans out of the whole region. And they saw this as a soft target, and to some degree it was.
According to the New York Times, a senior U.S. official in Washington, briefed on the reported arrest of Mughassil, said Wednesday that American authorities are still waiting for additional details, but expressed confidence the Khobar Towers attack mastermind is finally no longer at large.
Thank you, Victor.
All right, Susan.
For more on this story about the arrest of the alleged Khobar bombing mastermind, let's turn to Michael Lippin, who's right here with me at the Anchor Dex. Michael, who's been looking at what people are saying and about it on social media? What do you have for us?
Hi, Susan. Well, I've been looking at tweets mentioning hashtag Khobar, and I found a couple of tweets that make references to theories about what prompted the arrest of Ahmed al-Mughassil. One tweet is from the Washington bureau chief of the Al-Hayat Arabic newspaper, Joyce Karam. She's at Joyce_Karam, and she has 13,000 followers. Karam tweeted a link to a story on the Lebanon24.com news site along with this note. Report says arrest of Khobar suspect in Lebanon is a gesture from Iran to Saudi Arabia. Now, in that article, which is in Arabic, the writer suggests that the arrest was facilitated by Tehran because it wants to emphasize good intentions toward the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. That tweet by Joyce Karam also led to a discussion between her and Twitter user Faisal bin Farhan, who describes himself as a businessman based in Riyadh. Faisal bin Farhan wrote, "I don't know if Mugassil, the suspect, was burned by the Iranians, but it's a relatively cheap gesture to make as he has no current operational value." Well, Joyce Karam replied to that, "If true, Iran's role in his arrest carries a lot of symbolism, albeit no operational significance." Faisal bin Farhan then says, "Given the U.S. connection to the Khobar bombing, the suspect's arrest might be more a gesture to the Americans than to the Saudis." To which Karam replies, "Or a gesture to both. The move plays well ahead of the Saudi king's expected visit to the U.S. and before Congress votes on the Iran nuclear deal."
Well, what other theories about the arrest have you seen?
Well, I saw a tweet quoting an article on the Al Monitor news site. The blog is by Bruce Riedel, the director of the intelligence project at the Washington-based Brookings Institution. In that piece, Riedel writes that Mugassil's apprehension raises questions about why the 20-year-old manhunt for him ended now. He asks, "Is the Saudi news report about the arrest intended to remind Americans about Iran's long history of involvement in terrorism, just as the congressional debate on the Iran nuclear deal reaches its peak?" Riedel says the Saudis are very concerned that the deal will end Iran's isolation and strengthen its capacity for regional mischief. Susan?
Well, thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
People have burned incense for centuries. It has been used as a ceremonial element in religious rituals and in the home as a deodorizer, insect repellent, or for even meditation and aromatherapy. Now, Chinese researchers have found that burning incense indoors might be harmful to your health. When incense is burned, fine and ultra-fine particles are released into the air. These particles can be inhaled into the lungs, which can cause an inflammatory response. The researchers found that smoke from incense contains chemical properties that might modify and possibly mutate genetic material like DNA. They also learned that the smoke contained more toxins that can harm a body's cells and genetic material than cigarette smoke. The researchers said they hope their findings will lead to further evaluation of incense products on human health. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Despite recent focus on the State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications as a major effort to counter Islamic State propaganda, CSCC lacks the capacity to match the scale of ISIS's social media campaigns, according to Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, former coordinator of that center. He spoke with International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy, who joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Say, if we use numbers as an indicator, what did Ambassador Fernandez tell you?
Well, he said that the center had a dozen people working on that with just 6 Twitter accounts in 4 languages, Arabic, Urdu, Somali, and English. On the other hand, there was at least 2,000 to 3,000 serious pro-ISIS accounts. That's why Ambassador Fernandez concluded that even with other U.S. agencies' accounts and friendly governments' accounts, ISIS managed to outnumber the anti-ISIS social media campaign.
But if this group is committing horrible atrocities, why would its propaganda attract young Muslims to be recruited by the Islamic State group?
Well, so according to Ambassador Fernandez, people are recruited and radicalized for different reasons and in different ways.
The single content which was the most powerful content to mobilize people to go to Syria to fight was Syria, was the violence in Syria, was the carnage in Syria, especially we're talking about 2012, 2013, early 2014. In middle of 2014, with the declaration of the Baghdadi Caliphate, the rhetoric changes and the draw changes. Instead of being about go to Syria, fight and defend your Muslim brothers who are being slaughtered by al-Assad, it becomes go to Syria to live in this perfect state, in this divinely inspired, divinely protected state.
Ambassador Fernandez said, living in such perfect state that resembles the early era of the guided Islamic caliphs appealed to a lot of young Muslims from both East and West as well.
So if you're a young Muslim, you are not sure about your identity. And you have an organization that claims to be not just Muslim, but more Muslim, more authentic than anyone else, purer, harder, tougher than anyone else. The violence then is not something that repels, it's something that can attract, if it's presented the right way.
But if what Muslims are getting from ISIS propaganda is killing and raping and beheading, how would such propaganda appeal to young Muslims?
Ambassador Fernandez, who is fluent in Arabic, went actually through ISIS messages and found out that most of their propaganda is not about destruction, but actually about inviting Muslims to live what he called an authentic Muslim life.
If you're a naive person or a young person, a convert who's not strong in the faith, who doesn't know the history of Islam, who doesn't know the history of the Muslim world, you can see how they can be easily deceived by this. So that's the attraction.
So how could this propaganda be countered?
Well, that's what we will discuss in our next debriefing about my interview with the man who was heading the U.S. State Department's effort to counter the Islamic State group propaganda.
Thank you, Mohammed.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, a heart-wrenching murder. And from our country music vault, Girls Night Out. There is a tragic story that has taken place locally here in the United States. A young television reporter and her cameraman were gunned down during a live broadcast. 24-year-old Allison Parker and the 27-year-old cameraman Adam Ward were doing an interview near Roanoke, Virginia, with a local business leader who was wounded in the shooting. The alleged shooter sent a 23-page manifesto to a national news network in which he called himself a human powder keg. Vester Flanagan, a former employee of the same television station where the slain man and woman worked, shot himself when confronted by police and died hours later. Adam was engaged, and Allison was planning on marriage with her boyfriend and co-worker, Chris Hurst.
Adam and Melissa's love was just as white hot as mine is for Allison and hers was for me. I am happy to know that yesterday, when I sent her off, and basically I would come home from doing the 11 o'clock news and would make her breakfast and pack her a lunch and give her a kiss. She drove off in her car, and that was the last that I saw her, and it was a great morning. And before that, we celebrated her birthday on the Nantahala River in North Carolina, her favorite place on earth, where she went whitewater rafting with me, a close friend, and her parents. And it was the best time of her life, and she was just about to get started working on a new long-form special report, a series of reports on hospice care in this area that she had just secured interviews for. She was looking forward to life. I was looking forward to her life with her.
Hurst on the NBC Today show was asked about the gunman.
He obviously was in a state of mind that was not reasonable or rational. And so for me to speculate on his motivations for why, I think it does a disservice to Allison and Adam. I think that what we are starting to see is continued boldness from people who want to commit murders in cold blood for notoriety. And he did it to my sweet Allison. And he did it to Adam, and I have no words for him. I have no thoughts for him. My thoughts are of Allison and this book that she made for us for our six-month anniversary. We didn't have an anniversary, but we had month anniversaries, and here she said we were the cutest, newsiest, prettiest couple ever, and we are, and that's what my attention is today.
Thanks to NBC News for that recording. Joining me here in the studio is my colleague, Jeffrey Young. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. I think all of us have just been taken terribly by this story.
Yes, yes, it was a very sad day in broadcasting.
Susan, these two people were only in their 20s. They were just beginning their careers. And then they were just cut short by an act that clearly was lunacy.
And Jeffrey, you've been out there yourself doing this kind of broadcasting.
I was a street reporter in New York City. I have done multiple deployments to Iraq. I was in the Gulf War. The point of it is, in certain situations, you go out knowing that it is going to be dangerous, and you are keyed up from the instant you walk out the door. You have eyes in the back of your head. You are super hyper aware of your environment, and you see things in your periphery because this is a matter of survival. You're out getting a story as a reporter, but you've got to come back with the story intact, and that's the big deal about it.
And it seems that things are getting scarier and scarier here in the United States for journalists.
They are. We saw the Baltimore riots. We saw the disturbances in Ferguson, Missouri. Day after day, news crews are going out covering the news on city streets in America, and some of them are getting robbed. Some of them are getting chased by gunmen. It's getting to be lunacy. I hate to think of it as a situation where you can't go out and cover a story without having armed security, making sure that you can come back in one piece.
And there's shooting going on at some of these riots.
Absolutely. And these reporters get caught up in the shooting. Sometimes it's accidental and sometimes it's not.
And President Obama has spoken out about this subject several times.
Again and again, he has brought up the point, in his words, there needs to be a national dialogue on gun control. We need to gain control of this situation. We can't simply have a proliferation of firearms and unstable people armed to the teeth, out killing people. The shootings in the theaters, the things that have been going on day after day after day, it's guns after guns after guns. There's a right to have a gun in the United States, but there's also common sense.
Yes, especially in public places. This camera woman and the reporter, they were in a shopping area, a public place, and the person they were interviewing, none of them seemed aware that this gunman was coming for them.
And he just came out of nowhere.
Yes.
As you see in the video clip itself, she's in the middle of doing an interview with
live
his business leader. And suddenly she gets shot. And then you see the camera fall, and you know the cameraman went down as well.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey, for stopping by and sharing your thoughts about this story.
Our hearts are to everyone involved.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A bicycle that can't be stolen. More than 15 million bikes are stolen every year worldwide, including two bikes from a Chilean inventor, Andres Roy. So he and two friends, Juan Jose Monsalve and Cristobal Cabello, designed an unstealable bike. They call it the Yurka. The Yurka has a frame that turns into a lock. Part of the frame swivels out. Another part of the frame is also reconfigured so that both parts are connected around a bike rack, a guardrail, light pole, whatever. Since the aluminum frame is the lock, cutting the lock would destroy the bike. Andres Roy says despite the innovative security, the Yurka looks just like any other traditional bike.
But we also wanted to make it comfortable, a traditional bike design. We didn't want users to have to carry around a heavy lock either, and our technology can be adapted for any kind of bike.
The bike costs around $500 US, but as of now, they're sold out. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosson.
Naomi and Winona Judd were once one of the top country music acts in the United States, winning 5 Grammy Awards plus numerous Academy of Country Music and Country Music Association Awards. Now the duo is reuniting, and International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about Girls' Night Out.
If you're a fan of country music, the names Naomi and Winona Judd are very recognizable to you. But we haven't heard from the pair known as the Judds since the early 1990s. Nikki, that was when Naomi was diagnosed with hepatitis C.
Yes.
And she thought she'd never perform again.
Yep.
But we have good news.
Yes! She overcame, and of course, another residency is now in the works, another tour. They're going to be in Las Vegas, October 7th through the 24th. It's a residency. It's called Girls' Night Out, a nod to their 1985 number one hit.
It's a girls' night out, honey, there ain't no doubt. I'm going to dance every dance till the boys go home.
This is going to be the first joint performance for the mother duo in 5 years. They did the last encore tour back in 2010, 2011. The concert is going to feature some of their biggest hits. They're doing the set list. They're going to be doing Mama, He's Crazy, Why Not Me, Love Can Build a Bridge, which you know is the song of the title track of their last studio album. And it also marks their 25th anniversary of that album.
Wow. Yeah. And so this is going to be at the Venetian in Las Vegas?
Yes, at the Venetian. And also Wynonna is going to be performing tracks from her solo career as well.
Yeah, now Wynonna, we should mention, did go on to have a rather successful solo career after her mom had to leave the road.
Yes.
Because, you know, hepatitis C is a very serious disease,
yes,
and the rigors of touring, Naomi had no choice. I remember it was quite heart-wrenching for her.
Yeah, yeah. And also because you can die from hepatitis C.
Right.
So, and Wynonna is saying this tour, this residency rather, is she said she looked at it as an incredible opportunity to celebrate her mom.
Hmm.
And she even said, when this opportunity was presented to me, she was like, I had to take it. I have a new album coming out soon, and this is the perfect way to honor the roots that gave me the wings to fly.
Wow. Now, this residency thing, this is not the first time that a country act has done this. We had Brooks and Dunn have,
yes,
also done this.
Yes.
Reba McEntire,
yes,
has also done this.
Shania Twain.
Shania Twain has also done this.
Yes.
And so it's a way for people to go and see some of their country favorites without the country favorites having to go all over the country.
Also, Wynonna is working on a new album.
Oh.
Yes, so this is a great segue. It's a project with her husband. She's calling it, you know, it's vintage yet modern, but I think it's coming out next year.
All right, well, we look forward to that, and we look forward to hearing from you. You can send us a tweet at VOA underscore music. You can also send one to at VOA underscore IE for International Edition. And you can listen for Nikki's show, which is Country Hits USA, on our website, www.voanews.com.
Mama, he-
If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The government of Guinea and two main opposition parties there have signed an agreement to settle their dispute over terms of the upcoming presidential election, raising hopes of an inclusive and peaceful vote. The deal, reached after weeks of informal talks, allows for representation in local communal councils to reflect results of the 2013 legislative election. As part of the agreement, the government pledged to give the opposition representation in 128 of Guinea's 343 districts. The agreement also addresses the opposition's concern about the integrity of voter registration lists. The government agreed to establish a technical committee attached to the National Independent Electoral Commission to review the lists. Finally, there was agreement to replace two recently deceased members of the commission with opposition members. Guinea has made solid progress since its democratic transition in November 2010, but the terms of the October 11th presidential elections have been in dispute. The opposition has staged protests, some resulting in injuries and several deaths. The United States commends the agreement reached between Guinea's ruling and opposition political parties, which clears the way for Guinea to hold the first round of presidential elections next month. The government and opposition political parties demonstrated goodwill, flexibility, and a shared commitment to holding credible, inclusive, and peaceful elections. We remain committed to supporting the electoral process and urge the parties to continue dialogue throughout the election period, committing themselves and their supporters to nonviolence. We encourage all parties to build on this positive development by working together to prepare for the elections according to the new agreement. The United States sees a role for all Ghanaians in standing together at this important moment and ensuring the upcoming elections unify the nation and strengthen its democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.